We will go on to the next case of the day then, which is AVG Partners 1 LLC versus Genesis Health Clubs of Midwest. Justice Miller Lerman again is recused from this matter, and the court will be joined by Justice Friedenberg. Looks like everybody is in place right now. Mr. Betterman, good morning to you.
Good morning, Judge.
And you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Patrick Betterman. I represent appellants 24-Hour Fitness USA, whom I'll call 24, and Genesis Health Clubs of Midwest LLC, whom I'll call Genesis. I'll refer to the appellants jointly as Genesis 24 and to the appellee as AVG1. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The parties agree in their pleadings that 24 entered into the North Circle lease and the 145th lease with the two Dial landlords, that both leases were attached to the complaint, and that 24 assigned its tenant interest in the leases to Genesis. In its amended answer, Genesis 24 denied AG1's allegations that the Dial landlords assigned the two leases to AVG1. They denied that AVG1 was the owner of the two properties, and they denied that AVG1 was the landlord under the two leases. These denials put AVG1's privity of contract and standing directly in issue. Importantly, an overarching consequence in this case is neither of the Dial landlords is a party to this case, and therein lies the problem. For no deed to AVG1 for either property and no lease assignment to AVG1 for either lease was admitted into evidence at trial. As a result, AVG failed to prove its title to the lease properties and the leases. Genesis moved for a directed verdict of dismissal at the close of the evidence based on this failure of proof. The trial court overruled that motion, concluding there was sufficient secondary evidence of AG1's title to satisfy its burden of proof. Genesis 24 contends that AVG1's title was directly an issue and that AVG1 failed to prove its title to the properties and the leases as a matter of law, because AVG1 failed to enter into evidence deeds conveying the properties to AVG1 and assignments of the leases to AVG1. The secondary evidence that AVG1 relies upon is barred from consideration based on the parole evidence rule. This contention is based on In re Estate of Olson, where this court held that a deed or other minimum of title is required as evidence to prove title of real estate where ownership is directly at issue, as here.
Mr. Betterman.
Yes, sir.
Who does the record show that your client paid rent to?
I believe it shows AVG Partners.
Okay. And with respect to the amendment of the answer, at the hearing that took place on April 22 of 2019, does the colloquy that occurred between the court and counsel reflect the entirety of the amendment that was sought?
It encompassed the entirety of the affirmative defenses. There was no discussion of any of the underlying allegations.
Is that a yes or is that a no?
Well, I guess it's a yes and a no. There was no discussion of any changes in the underlying answer as to the responses to the allegations. There was discussion about the defenses. I filed a motion. I attached the answer that I wanted to propose to that motion. I assumed that the counsel on the other side would read it and understand it. And it was clear what was said and denied in that motion. You see, Judge, before that motion to amend was filed, the issue of AVG1's title was already an issue because 24 had denied that it was the landlord and 24 had denied it was the ownership. Genesis inconsistently admitted ownership and the lease. So I had two defendants whose answers I was going to consolidate, and I made them a denial. I consolidated. I put it in writing. Anybody could read it and understand it. You know, I mean, if you're going to amend a complaint, you read the whole thing to figure out what's changed. And I don't understand how counsel from California can come into this court and suggest that I did something surreptitious or something wrong. I did not. Everything was above board. It was on the table. The judge told the counsel that, hey, Betterman's going to go ahead and eliminate the surrender defense. He's going to file this exact answer that's attached to the motion. Is that okay with you? And Mr. Bordeaux answered, yeah, it was. He thought it was just fine. So this whole issue, however, I would point out to the court, was not raised in the court below. There was no motion to strike the answer. And as this court is wont to find, if an issue isn't raised below, it ain't going to come up for the first time before you on appeal. And that rule in State versus Haas and many, many other cases applies here. That wasn't raised below. In any event, and that's their first claim, that somehow there was an estoppel or some impropriety in the matter of the answer. The answer to that question is there was nothing done that was surreptitious or wrong. It was all above board. It was done in accordance with the appropriate ethical standards required. And I take umbrage at anyone that suggests that I did anything wrong there. I did it right. Everything was above board. Everything was on the table.
Before your time runs down too far, would you please address how we should approach the hearsay question with respect to the website of the treasurer or the assessor or whichever official it happens to be? Isn't when a public body, a public agency puts its records up for the public to see on a website that's an official website, isn't that an exception to the hearsay rule?
Well, first of all, you have to have a sponsoring witness that's going to tell you it is a public record and how it's maintained.
Doesn't that sort of website authenticate itself?
Well, you have to understand, Judge, that the entire issue on that is a little bit more complicated than just that. It is that they failed to comply with 27-1005. You see, when they put in those evidence of those records from the website, they put in copies. Therefore, 25-901 provisions don't apply to copies. You have to, as the State versus Rice clearly holds, you have to authenticate them. Under 27-1005, the exception to the hearsay or the original writing rule for public documents. That wasn't done here. These documents were just as inadmissible as the documents in State versus Rice where that fellow's freedom was at risk. The other aspect of it is that they required to get the certification under 27-1005 that it was a public record, which they didn't have. More importantly, when she authenticated it, she claimed it was a record at first of the assessor's office. She didn't even have the right public office. She had no clue about anything relating to that article. Now, if you want to talk about whether stuff that's coming off the website is going to be admissible, number one, you got to have an original. And it's true that under the definition of original in our evidentiary statutes, something hot off the press would be an original, but that's not what happened here. They were copies. Once you get a copy, then you get fallen into 27-1005. I would like to point out, if I've answered that particular aspect, I would like to point out that, well, so the bottom line is, by the way, there are many federal records that are self-authenticating. We have no self-authentication in this state for stuff on the line. And if you don't have the original, you've got a copy, then you got to comply with 27-1005. And that is our law on this point.
In this situation, what are you contending would have been the original?
Well, the original would have been a certified copy from the assessor's office of the underlying records, which is the way it should have been proven.
So the website, your basic argument is the website doesn't qualify.
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is if you had an original off the website, okay, and that was an original document, not a copy. The copy is covered by 27-105. If you had an original document, then you could, if you had enough foundation for the sponsoring witness, get that in as an original under 27-901.
So, in the context of a website, what are you contending would be the original? I think that's maybe where I'm not totally following your argument.
All right. If you will look at the definition of copies and originals in the statutes at 27. I'm sure you're very familiar. You will agree with me that if I print something off of a computer, that the copy that comes right off the computer is an original. It's an original. They didn't do that. They took that original and I believe made copies. And that's the difference here. It's a technical argument, but once you got a copy, then you got to bring it in under 27.105, because that's what that statute says.
They made a copy or did they make a duplicate?
Well, I have to think they're the same.
Right.
You got an original, and the exception for public records, for copies of public records, is 27.105, which throws you back into 27.902 for self-authentication.
Let's revert back to the paper world for just a minute. Assume you have a certified copy of a birth certificate. We're all familiar with the certified copy that comes with the raised seal. Somebody plops that down on a photocopy machine and makes a copy that shows the raised seal, shows everything, and for purposes of my question, there's no flaw in the copying process. Is that duplicate admissible as a public record?
Well, you're getting into the original writing issue. It is not an original. So it's not going to go in as an original. And the issue would be whether it's a duplicate. Because it's certified, all right, it's got a good certification, it may well come in as a duplicate under 27.1002. But that's different here because you don't have the certification. That's the gift of 27.1005, because it requires the certification of the record. So what you posit is a situation where you could have a copy that would come in under as a duplicate and would be admissible because it's certified. Whereas if it's a copy it's not certified, then you'll have to come in under 27.105.
Okay.
That's why all the federal cases and all that are distinguishable. 27.105 wasn't in play in any of those decisions where they want to put everything on the internet into evidence and before you. I'm not saying it's a bad rule, but particularly in the age we're in. I'm just saying with the limitations we have under 27.105, and when you're dealing with a copy, and if it's, I confess, if it's an original, it's different. But, you know, in State versus Rice, the Rice Poindexter guy, he lost his freedom because he didn't have it properly certified under 27.105. And that's a pretty serious effect, and this is a pretty serious rule. So I'd love to have told you about Olson, but you all know about Olson anyway. So that's okay, Judge. There's more sex appeal to this issue of records from the internet. So.
Thank you.
I'm zeroed out, I believe.
Yeah, the chief's microphone was off, I think.
Oh, okay.
My microphone was off. Thank you, Mr. Betterman. Mr. Bordo, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. This was a straightforward rent collection case brought by a landlord against tenants who wholly admitted to intentional failures to pay. The evidence showed that these intentional failures to pay were part of a strategic decision to force the landlord to either renegotiate terms of the leases, terminate the leases, or to sell the property. Now, with respect to the issue of whether plaintiff had standing, the appellants rely upon authorities that are applicable to requirements for proving up title to or interest in real property. This is a contract case. AVG need only have proven that it was the party to the contract to whom the payment obligations were owed. AVG's right to collect arises from the contract, not ownership of the property. Possession was not at issue in the case. There are numerous circumstances in which the landlord under a lease is not the owner of the property. Whether AVG was the landlord under the leases was a factual question supported by really almost overwhelming evidence, and that was direct evidence, not secondary evidence. and it was primarily admissions by the appellants themselves. We had Exhibit 109, which was a written assignment of the leases from 24 Hour to Genesis, which specifically identified AVG as the landlord under the leases. We had Exhibits 125 and 126, which were real estate listing agreements entered into by Genesis with agents to find subtenants, in which Genesis acknowledged that AVG was the landlord under the leases. We had Exhibit 112, which were checks, numerous checks from Genesis to AVG for rent under the leases. We had Exhibit 212, which was a letter from Genesis's counsel regarding the lease defaults, in which it identified, he identified the parties to the leases and the landlord as AVG. And we had abundant testimony from Genesis's own president, Rodney Stephen, in which he discussed attempting to negotiate the issues with AVG as the landlord and said, quote, AVG was obligated to take care of their landlord responsibilities, close quote. And that's at Bill of Exceptions 165.19 to 166.7. And finally, of course, we had testimony from AVG's CFO stating that AVG is the landlord under the leases. So this issue really is the proverbial red herring. With respect to the issue of prejudgment interest, Your Honors, we would submit that the appellants had both notice and suffered no prejudice. During the trial, AVG's CFO was cross-examined about AVG's prejudgment interest claim. In fact, she was asked by appellant's counsel on cross-examination, quote, you made a claim for interest in this case, didn't you, close quote. And then she was asked, quote, the landlord is making a claim for interest, true? And she answered in the affirmative to both questions that interest was being sought on the unpaid rent amounts. She was later asked, how is it, quote, the landlord gets to collect a whopping 12% interest on rent not paid on time, close quote. On direct examination, Ms. Trendley, the CFO, testified about Exhibit 117, which was a summary of AVG's damages claims, which included line items for prejudgment interest. Appellant's counsel objected to those entries, stating that prejudgment interest was a legal issue. After the close of evidence, appellant's counsel commenced an argument regarding whether or not AVG's claims were liquidated or unliquidated, which is an argument that would only go to the question of prejudgment interest. And ultimately, the court, in its order on the judgment and prejudgment interest, indicated that the issue had been extensively briefed and argued by the parties prior to the entry of judgment. With respect to the lack of prejudice, not only did the appellants not suffer any prejudice because they litigated the issue of prejudgment interest during the trial, and engaged in extensive briefing and argument regarding the issue before the entry of judgment, but also because there's absolutely nothing that appellants could have or would have done differently during the trial had the issue of prejudgment claim for interest have been expressly prayed for in the third amended complaint.
How does the argument that you're making square with the Life Investors Insurance Company case and the Higgins case?
Sure. Life Investors has no indication of there being an independent statutory basis. In that case, the claims were for fraud and payment by mistake, with no indication that the defendant had any knowledge that prejudgment interest was being sought. So in these cases in which there is either no independent statutory basis for prejudgment interest, or there is an indication that the defendant did not have an opportunity to respond to, or as in this case, actually litigate the issue during trial, then the purposes underlying the whole question are satisfied by the notice and the lack of prejudice that was suffered. With respect to the issue of whether the claims are liquidated or unliquidated, we would respectfully submit that if we were to find that a contract claim that is easily ascertainable and not subject to reasonable dispute, such as calculating rent due under a lease, becomes unliquidated because of a mitigation affirmative defense, there probably won't be many liquidated damages claims that come before the courts. With respect to the issue of the property taxes, The property tax claim brought by AVG was with respect to the principal amount of property taxes and the interest imposed by statute, as the county treasurer is required to do, for 2016, 2017, and the first installment of 2018. Now, the principal amounts of the unpaid taxes and some of the interest were shown on these printouts from the county treasurer's official website, and the balance of the interest claimed through the date of trial was the 14% that is required to be taxed on by the treasurer under 45104.01. These printouts were data compilations prepared by the treasurer's office as required by Nebraska law, with information obviously known to the treasurer's office. And indeed, making those records is an official duty of the county treasurer under Section 77-1801 and 77-1821. Numerous federal courts, including the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, have held that printouts from official government websites are admissible business or public records. See, for example, United States versus Iverson, 818 F3rd 1015, a 10th Circuit 2016 case.
So was this a printout or was this a copy, and does that make a difference?
I think it makes no difference. It was a printout. Obviously, there's only so much you can do when you are trying to translate what's on the website to a document that becomes an exhibit at trial, viewable by the jurors and the court, et cetera. So when you push print on the computer and the website screen prints out, candidly, that's inherently a duplicate, I suppose, in and of itself, but it is as close as you can get to the original, practically speaking, under today's technology. The document comes out with the indication that it is from the county treasurer's office, that it, and so it is self-authenticating. And a, in essence, Xerox copy of that page does not undermine its trustworthiness or its self-authentication as an official document. I suppose the only thing we could do is would be to require litigants to bring in a computer and simultaneously check the website while they're sitting there. That creates temporal considerations that may be problematic. But it's also important to note that because it's a public record information item, it is equally available to all of the parties. And in this case, the appellants at no time questioned whether the information contained thereon was in fact accurate and from the website, whether it lacked any trustworthiness, or pointed to any indications other than this this sort of hyper-technical argument of it being a copy. Other than that, there was no challenge to the information that was contained on the website or printed out.
Mr. Bordo, yes. Does it make a difference whether or not the state statute requires the public official, in this case the treasurer, to maintain a website? That clearly requires them to maintain records in their office, but assume for purposes of my question that there is no statute that requires them to maintain a website. What impact, if any, does that have on the hearsay analysis?
I don't think it has any, because the fact of the matter is that they are required by law to maintain the information and keep a record of that information so that it is publicly available. Keeping of that record technologically has now progressed to the point where it is maintained and dispersed, if you will, publicly via the website. And so I would view the website as simply the mechanical vehicle, as opposed to perhaps posting a notice on the city hall door. It's now become posting it on a website through the internet. And so I don't see that that would have an impact on the hearsay analysis. I've lost the clock, but I suspect my time is up.
Your time is up, as a matter of fact, and I don't believe we have any time for rebuttal. Is that correct?
No time for rebuttal.
That is correct. There is no time for rebuttal. That means our argument on this case has concluded, and in fact, all of this morning's cases, arguments have concluded. So the court is adjourned, and you all are excused. And again, thank you very much for participating by WebEx on these particular arguments. Thank you all. Have a good day.